The Free Speech Coalition.
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 The Free Speech Coalition. Podcast.
Welcome to the Free Speech Coalition podcast. My name is Patrick Korsch, and today we are sitting down with Melissa Darby, a lecturer at AUT, who is, is it a school of teacher education still?
No, I'm in Te Ata Pautama, the Faculty of Māori and Indigenous Development.
Oh, fantastic. Okay. Well, welcome to you, Melissa.
Thank you.
So before we start, why don't you tell our listeners what field of research that you specialize in and also what your interest in free speech is?
I have a reasonably broad area of interest. So my master's degree was in arts, and I looked at identity and did quite a big piece of historical research with my tribal group in Tauranga. My PhD was part of a Better Start National Science Challenge, so that's where the education part comes into play. And I looked at early literacy with children. But in addition to that, I have a general interest in issues of culture, identity, identity politics, and that's partly from a lot of reading I've done, partly from experiences I've had, and partly from research that I've been involved with. So, yeah, sort of a, my research crosses a few different areas.
Yeah, goodness, and it's extremely topical nowadays.
It sure is. And as for my interest in free speech, I mean, it's really... I find it baffling that people sort of can't have an interest in free speech, and certainly in this day and age. We, for me, as an academic and as a person who enjoys thinking and I guess, exploring different issues, to me, the idea that we are being silenced increasingly and the inextricable link that freedom of speech has with freedom of thought, you know, I think these are big issues, so they certainly warrant more of a conversation around them.
Yeah, for sure. And as, with your experience as an academic, you must feel a great amount of pressure, or at least increasing pressure, over this, on saying the right things. Or, in the academic world, political correctness must be just stifling nowadays.
I think so, definitely. Yeah. Increasingly, I see in certain disciplines, not necessarily in all, and I certainly can't speak for areas that I'm not in. But more and more we see students being taught this is not how to think, but what you must think.
Yeah.
And it's important to have an opinion, and this is the opinion you need to have. So to me, to arrive at an informed opinion, you look at option A, you look at option B, you weigh up the pros and cons, I guess, of each idea, and then from that process you draw some sort of conclusion, which is informed and it's gone through some sort of process around what's logical, what's rational, what may be practical, a whole host of different factors. When we tell students this is what you must think, we deny them that ability to engage in that process, but also we are telling them that isn't even important, that's not what you need to do. So increasingly you see a lot of students who just mimic or repeat rhetoric that they've been indoctrinated with by people who say this is what you must think, and they don't know even to consider another side of the debate. And if they are put in that position, they either can't debate or the only option they have is to shut down what you're saying.
Right. It's funny how it's usually the tactics or the particular lens in which they teach students this sort of thing nowadays is under the guise of critical theory or critical thinking. But it's not critical thinking as a mechanism. It's an actual theory where the thing that you're being critical of is the current hegemonic trends of the time or something, which could be right, could be wrong. But if all you're doing is just criticizing what's going on around you, that's not critical thinking. And it's a bit sad that students don't seem are not taught the difference between the mechanism in which you analyze ideas critically and the body of knowledge, or the school of thought, where what you're describing here is being critical of, you know, whatever is around you. It's such a shame.
Oh, it's a huge shame, and I think it's part and parcel of exactly what you said. A critical, almost being critical for criticism's sake.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. Where you take a system that's always that's been in existence for X number of years, generations often, centuries even, and you just say, I don't like it, simply because it's been around for a long time. And often we see that with a lot of things associated with the West or with the so-called patriarchy or with anything, you know, white or that sort of rhetoric. And instead of weighing up the options and looking at whether something is actually a good idea, it's about who is saying it, what they determine the origins of that theory or that system to have been. Increasingly we see history viewed, and I actually teach history, we see it viewed as being viewed through nowadays, so contemporary lenses placed on historical occurrences or even people in the past. I just saw an article this morning saying that Mahatma Gandhi needs to be torn down because he was racist. Now, if Mahatma Gandhi isn't safe, then who is?
Who is, exactly. And it must be very difficult for the sort of study that you're involved in, specifically being an analyzer of culture and identity politics. So you're right in the thick of it.
Yes, yes. And that's sort of something I haven't done a huge amount of research in as part of projects or anything in, but it's certainly a big area of mine based on observational experiences, but also in a lot of reading that I do. And I find it fascinating, this culture wars, if you like, that we're in at the moment. Recently, I was fortunate enough to have been awarded a Fulbright Award, and I was in America for a year. I came back middle of this year, and a couple of experiences there made me really question a lot of the stuff around diversity and inclusion and all of the things that people, we hear so often these days that it's become sort of part of the furniture almost in policy documents and universities and so on, and increasingly in the corporate sector, in public sector as well. And when I was there, I attended a couple of events with Fulbright, and at each of them, I was the only person from New Zealand. There were often 60 or 80 countries represented and upwards of 150 people there. So hugely diverse in terms of different backgrounds, cultures, languages, religion, and so on. And we were sitting down having breakfast one morning and marvelling at all of the different foods we ate for breakfast and whether we thought one country had good food or the other country had bad food and so on. And then we started the session for the day, and it was about our hopes and dreams and fears and challenges and things that we thought we'd have in the US. It was not long after I arrived. And all of our responses were exactly the same. And I came to the conclusion that we are far more alike than we are different.
Right.
That while we ate different things for breakfast, we still actually all ate breakfast.
Exactly.
All of our the challenges and the hopes and things we had for our time in the US and beyond were the same. But instead these days we see increasingly people divided, that because you are of this race, sexuality, gender mostly, to a lesser extent religion, we can't talk to one another. And I find that really quite frightening and really extremely damaging. So I started to question some of the ideas around diversity, where increasingly we see it's about superficial diversity. And if you have a diverse opinion or you deviate from the orthodoxy, that isn't okay.
Right. When do you think that this started? You know, or when did you start actually seeing these sorts of policies and the idea that you can't speak to someone really come into the mainstream?
I feel like I had more exposure to it when I started my PhD 3 years ago. Right. And a couple of personal experiences where I started to learn about different theories and different thoughts, I guess, that students are being taught in certain fields. And I thought, well, that doesn't really make sense. And often in the real world, I saw quite a disconnect in some areas between what universities were teaching and what I saw in people's lives. So I questioned a couple of things around particular narratives, I guess, and that didn't go down well.
Right.
So for me, rather than the arguments that I put forward being debated and either refuted because I was wrong, and I'm happy to change my view if somebody thinks I'm wrong and convinces me of that fact. And rather than the people who sort of had these views engaging with me and saying, no, here's where you're wrong and this is why we think we're right, I just got completely shut down. So I was told I was, you know, my mind was colonized, that I was dangerous, that to Māori in particular, which is ironic because I, you know, I'm Māori myself, so I'm not sure how that all works, that I shouldn't be questioning the orthodoxy and that, you know, this would really damage my career. And I've had people seek to end my career on the basis of these ideas that I, or these questions really that I've asked. So I started to look more seriously at these issues based on personal experience rather than anything else.
Interesting. So the one of the big reasons why we have you on the podcast at the moment is just 2 days ago, Massey University had canceled the Feminism 2020 event at the Wellington campus, I believe.
Yes, that's right. This
is after withstanding a few weeks of significant criticism and calls for cancellation. Now, the Free Speech Coalition originally praised Massey for standing up to this. We thought they had learned their lesson, the cancellation of Dr. Don Brash. But they finally caved. Can you tell us what exactly happened?
Yes, as far as I know, now I'm not actually part of Speak Up for Women, but I was asked to speak at the event basically because of some of the things that I'd spoken out about, and they thought I had some interesting ideas and that I'd be someone who could make a contribution to their talk. So I was really happy to accept the invitation. From what I understand, the event was booked by the organiser of the event, who is a Massey student herself, so she has access to be able to book those various rooms. The booking was confirmed. As soon as the event started to be publicised, that created a lot of, a real fuss, I guess, to say the least, in certain groups of students in Massey and in the wider community in New Zealand, who then petitioned to have the event shut down. Ironically, calling and saying that holding the event on campus would make them feel unsafe. Now, the event is actually held out of term time, out of semester time, when there will be no students on campus anyway. So a lot of these students who are claiming that they would feel unsafe, I can't quite work that out, how you are unsafe if you're physically not there. I don't know, but anyway, that was their argument. Massey, unfortunately, then went through, I believe, a review, I guess, of the event and of the dangers they perhaps were being told about from students. And based on the Health and Safety Act, they cancelled the event after seeking legal advice. So,
well, they've learned something.
Hugely disappointed.
Yeah.
Sorry?
They've definitely learned something. Consult your lawyers first. Goodness.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, to be honest, they put out a press release about 3 weeks or so ago now about the event, and that was one, I think, that the Free Speech Coalition praised, that yes, they acknowledged some students and staff, I believe, felt unsafe. However, they had a commitment to free speech and academic freedom and would be going ahead with the booking. They, in that said, we do not in any way agree with the views of the speakers at the event. Now, I found that extraordinary because I hadn't said anything. In fact, I hadn't even written my speech at that point or my talk, nor have I done so now. I just had some ideas in my head.
Right.
So I don't even know what I was going to say, and I don't know how Massey University disagreed with me when I hadn't
exactly
said a word. I actually wrote to the Vice-Chancellor to ask that question, how do you know that you disagree with me if you don't know what I'm going to say? Particularly when my talk was going down, not so much feminism, because that's for other people to, the other speakers to really explore, but rather down this idea of identity politics and the almost like imploring people to find a way for us to be able to talk and engage with one another in a respectful way, in constructive way. That was the essence of my message.
There's such a sad irony that this is precisely the situation.
Yeah,
it's precisely the phenomenon which cancelled the event in the first place. And it's,
right. And the irony is exquisite, really, that here I was talking about censorship and the need for us to find ways to connect and really to see our shared humanity. I read a lot of Martin Luther King when I was in the US and did quite a bit of research into his philosophies. And that was at the heart of my message, that we're more similar than we are different, and we need to find ways to connect and to engage without hurling this vitriol at one another, and you know, but instead the exact thing, I guess they've kind of proven my point, really. that this is becoming a real issue.
So touching up on Martin Luther King then, I mean, I thought the whole one of his greatest quotes was, we shouldn't judge people by the color of their skin, but the content of their character, right?
Of course,
and
of course.
You can expand that to not only color of one's skin, but also sexual identity, gender, etc.
Exactly.
Why do you think that certain identity groups have abandoned one of their great heroes' warnings over this?
Oh, gosh, that's a great question. I mean...
Sorry to put the hard questions
No, I mean, that is a really good question. I don't know. I mean, I wonder... It feels like there's a lot of threads playing into this wider tapestry, I guess, and forming this wider tapestry, where one is... I wonder how much people have really thought through some of the... stakes they put in the ground over particular issues. So while something may seem like a good idea in the abstract sense, the practical application of that has implications for other people. And that's part of, for example, the idea of transgender rights, if you like, is a good idea in the abstract. And it's very easy to say, well, of course nobody should be discriminated against based on any... you know, aspect of their identity. But the practical application of saying, okay, from that thing, we're going to take this giant leap to just letting people identify as they please in terms of their sex. We're going to have the conflation of sex and gender and all of these different things. It actually has implications in the real world, and that's what I think this event and Speak Up for Women in general has formed over, the need to have conversations around these issues. Another issue, I guess, is one of power at the heart of it. There's a lot of talk these days around who has power in society. So the more, I quote, oppressed and marginalized you've been, the more you want to gain power. And there's a lot of things, I think, that play into what we're seeing nowadays. The complete, I guess, throwing the baby out with the bathwater in terms of anything that's emerged from the West.
Right.
It's really, I mean, while of course all of these people who are ranting and raving about the West enjoy a lot of the benefits of living in a Western society, so I find a lot of it quite hypocritical, to be honest.
Yeah. I've always likened it to the analogy that you're on the ocean. You've got a wooden rowboat, and you said, okay, let's reconstruct the rowboat by ripping up the floorboards, and as you're deconstructing the boat, water's coming in, and you don't.
Yeah.
What are you gonna build in this new boat out of? You know, probably the very same wooden slats that the original rowboat was.
Yeah, that's a great analogy. And so, as for Martin Luther King, I mean, he's been sort of, I guess, condensed down to these sound bites and almost Hallmark cards in the sense of, you know, he's a dream and it all sounds really good, but can we actually find a way to make that dream he had a reality? I think it's becoming increasingly more difficult in these culture wars and identity wars we find ourselves in. And I mean, some of his lesser known quotes, and the one I actually wrote at the start of this piece I wrote on identity politics after my experiences in the US was he used, I believe, in his speech around Vietnam, and he started to question some of, you know, step outside, I guess, his civil rights box and question some of the broader issues he saw facing humanity, and one, of course, was the Vietnam War.
Right.
And he talked about, you know, in order to sort of save mankind, we needed to find a way to connect. So not based on all these groups that we've formed, but actually of on our shared humanity. So he really hit the nail on the head, and this is in 1967, I believe, rather than, you know, some years later, we seem to be worse off than in his time.
That's an interesting point, because I hear a lot of the rhetoric nowadays praising our ability to, well, that we are diverse. And I hear this slogan, diversity is our strength.
Mm.
There's nothing wrong with diversity. In fact, you know, I think it should be celebrated in many cases.
Mm,
but what you're talking about is instead of focusing as that as being the be all and end all, the real strength should be common cause and what makes us similar.
Yes.
And instead of focusing on our differences, which the slogan diversity is our strength really draws upon our attention towards, it should be we're all people. We all want a job. We all want to have wonderful, healthy families, and we all want to have friends and live a very good life. We seem to have forgotten.
Of course, absolutely, and that was one of my key messages at this Feminism 2020 event. And you know that, I mean, it's almost like you've read the piece I wrote, because it's almost exactly what I said, that diversity on its own isn't enough. We have to have it in conjunction with some form of unity where we're working towards a common goal, where we recognize our similarities, which are far greater than our differences. To a large extent, our differences are quite superficial, and that's not to diminish different people's, you know, culture and
right.
religion or anything like that. But at the end of the day, we all sort of get up, eat something, go off and do something for the day, whether that's work or study or school or whatever it might be. We have sort of socialized and families and friends, and we have hopes and dreams and goals in our lives, and that, to varying degrees, of course, of different challenges people may have, but that's it in a nutshell, I guess.
Right.
And so we're very similar, and a lot of the differences that we talk about may be, they're quite superficial, and that's okay. We may speak different languages, or we may eat different food, or whatever the case may be, or have different ways of viewing the world, yes, but ultimately, we need to find some common ground amongst all of this, and I think connect over that rather than continue to create these groups that just polarize and create so much division.
Right.
I recently read, or I'm reading Douglas Murray's book, The Madness of Crowds.
I'm reading that at the moment as well.
Yeah, you've read it?
No, I'm reading it now at the moment. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Oh, great. I will have to exchange ideas on that later.
Yeah, absolutely.
But he, you know, I saw an interview with him where he talks about this idea where we are not, it's not about what's being said anymore, but the person delivering the message. And if you're sort of a white male, you're at the bottom of the heap in terms of anyone listening to you anymore. But if the message is coming from someone, a woman of colour, for example, you're slightly higher up the list, and so on and so forth. And by that, you know, with that idea, we are necessarily trapped by the circumstances of our birth, these arbitrary things about who we are, and we're sort of reduced to nothing more than gender, skin pigmentation, sexual orientation, and the richness of what we are as people and who we are as people is completely cast aside in favor of these really sort of arbitrary things about who we are as people.
Absolutely. I really do not understand this, just because, you know, speaking as a blank, or my experience as a blank, somehow qualifies the arguments that you are about to purport. Like, for instance, I use this example. If I said 2 + 2 = 4, and someone else of a different race or ethnicity, culture, religion, sexual identification, what have you, were to say the same thing, well, you can't say that I'm any less right, because I'm stating an objective fact. But in many cases, especially when it comes down to social policy or particular practices, which, you know, are very messy, I grant you that, it seems as though we no longer look at the objectivity of the statement and more the who is saying it, which is completely illogical the way that I see things.
Yes. No, it is. And increasingly, I mean, facts, you know, we're almost living in a post-fact world where people have this tendency to disregard facts as merely somebody else's opinion. Well, you may think 2 + 2 = 4, but I think it's 5. And and that's not how things work.
No.
But of course, I read something recently that suggested that, you know, logic and sort of rational thinking and so on was a product of Western academic, you know, traditions.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
That's evil, necessarily evil, just because it's come from there rather than weighing up its value on its own merits.
I've heard calls for the decolonization of mathematics and the hard sciences, which I don't understand how you can. I mean, calculus is calculus, regardless of who invented it or discovered it first.
But, of course. And I actually also have issues with this word decolonization. When I was in the US, you hear it a lot, and I genuinely wanted to know what it means. And so I asked somebody who was about to deliver a lecture on decolonization, oh, great, you'll know. Can you please tell me what it means? And he said, what do you mean? What does it mean? I said, well, kind of exactly that. I really would love to have how would you explain it? I actually don't understand what it means in practical terms. And he said he didn't know, that the students he felt had some exposure to it in other courses, so he didn't need to explain it to them, that they knew what it meant. And I said, well, in reality, what does a decolonized world look like to you? I mean, what's a decolonized tax rate, for example? And if you don't decolonize absolutely everything, isn't that then undermining the process itself? Do you know what I mean? Like, it's a really...
Yes.
It's where that hypocrisy comes into play again, and where... It's sort of cherry picking. Well, we don't like this and we don't like that, but we actually do like this and we do like that. So we'll keep that and sort of ignore the origins of that.
That's really concerning. The sort of we know it when we see it, or those that have experienced decolonization in other classes, university classes, for instance, have. They know it, and so I don't need to explain or come up with the objective concept for the rest of you. It's a sort of a priori or before experience account or holding of knowledge that really can't be expressed to other people. And I'm having a problem with if you identify a problem with the way society is, and there are many. If you can't communicate to that to people who don't know that there's a problem with society, how do you expect the majority to agree or subscribe to your solutions?
I don't know, and I think, I mean, what you said is right, that we'll get to it when we see it. We'll know, and I believe the Prime Minister recently used that line. And it's really quite frightening, because it makes it about the struggle, the eternal struggle, rather than any sort of resolution. Mm. Because, and I think we see that increasingly when you look, for example, at issues that in Martin Luther King's time, for example, they were real issues. Now, I'm not saying for us that we're perfect now. No, not at all. And I'm not diminishing experiences that people have of... I guess, genuine, if you like, racism or discrimination or bigotry or whatever the case may be. Mm. However, we've come pretty far, I think, as a society. Yet, when we see definitions of words shifting in order to fit certain narratives, when we see reshaping of history in order to suit contemporary agenda, when we see the goalposts constantly moving, to me, I wonder if it's now actually about having the struggle rather than
finding
any sort of resolution.
Right. So, speaking of solutions, we've identified this problem. We have conflicting identity groups not talking to one another. And it looks to me as though it's getting increasingly worse, if not in the States, especially, or in the UK, especially in New Zealand. So how do we go about de-anti-free speeching our society?
Wow.
That's another hard question.
It is a hard question. But actually, given I'd had some not particularly pleasant experiences based on a few things that I had said and questioned, when I was asked to be a part of this or to speak at the Speak Up for Women event, after I agreed, actually, it was quite amusing. The organizer said, oh, by the way, you might get a bit of flack for being involved in this. And I thought, oh, gosh, not again. And I thought about it and agreed in the finish to do it, because I think the more that we shy away from confronting these issues, and I intend 100% to speak respectfully and to engage and offer something hopefully constructive, and that people will either disagree with me or agree with me on, that's fine either way. But if they disagree, I hope that they, A, will address the issues rather than me personally, which has happened a lot, or whether they will, disagree in a respectful and constructive way. So that in that process, at the end of that conversation, hopefully some sort of, not consensus necessarily, but we're all better off for having had that conversation, a step closer, if you like, to some sort of truth.
Right.
I think that if I had said no, I didn't want to do this because I didn't want to, you know, engage in things that were difficult and to have accusations of white supremacy and anti-TERF and, well, TERF or whatever the thing is, I didn't even know what that term meant until recently, hurled at me based on, you know, and haven't even opened my mouth. I wouldn't have agreed to do it, but I think the more that we shy away from these conversations, the more that we, I guess, let the bullies win, because I think that's exactly what they are. None of them have fronted up over this issue. They've all been very vocal about how horrible this event is, but when they've had opportunities to go and defend their position on this, they won't. Then I think that's a real problem. So I guess for me, I'd encourage everyone to, if you have thoughts around the value of free speech and the need for us to protect it, if we have thoughts around particular issues we're facing as a society, I know it's hard to speak up because of the McCarthyism tactics,
right, yeah.
People use, but I guess as best as we can to speak up, because what's been interesting in this Feminism 2020 event is the number of people have come out and said, yeah, I'm concerned about this too. So
that's interesting.
Yeah, hopefully that's something.
Yeah. One of our most recent podcasts was with Annie O'Brien, one of the spokespersons for it. And she expressed her observation that a lot of members of Speak Up for Women had been left members of whatever ideology you want to subscribe to. And they had not seen a free speech as a particular issue until it happened to them. And they go, whoa, this is ridiculous. And it just reminds me of that that poem, you know, first they came for such and such, and then they came for such and such, and then they came for me, and there was no one left to speak up for me. And it's I know that that's usually used as an example for particular marginalized groups and how we need to defend them, as we should. But it's it also is equally applicable to you know, civil liberties like free speech, where it's now happening to the most, you know, to groups that you wouldn't believe. I mean, this is feminism for this is a feminist.
I know.
And now we're stopping feminists from talking.
And feminism itself, I mean, gosh, it's not an area that I'm hugely familiar with. So ironically, I've never sort of labelled myself, I guess, as a feminist. But if me wanting to express concern about policies and changes to legislation that I feel impact on me as a woman, if that gets me labelled a feminist, so be it.
Right.
But if women getting together, irrespective of where they are, their views on feminism or their views on whatever the case may be, if a group of women getting together to discuss things that they feel impact on them as women is now classified as hate speech in this country, then we are all in big trouble.
Trouble, right. One final, and I think this is a particularly hard question, but given your background in studying of identity politics, free speech, I think in this country now, especially with the Stefan Molyneux, Lauren Southern case, has been quartered off as a right-wing issue. I think this is a clear example that it's not a right-wing issue, because I know a lot of people, like Annie O'Brien, are not right-wing.
Yes, and typically I haven't been either.
No, right, exactly. What do you think needs to happen in order for us not to ensure that it's considered a right-wing thing? I mean, I have seen on Twitter now quite a few members of particular, you know, of the right, now saying, well, it's finally happened to them, good riddance and stuff.
Yeah, that's and never...
That's not a good thing. That's not a good thing.
I mean, that's to me is bad, I guess. You know, and I think to go back to King's, you know, talk around character and so on, you know, a mark of someone's character, I guess, is if you'd kind of beat them with the same stick that you were just beaten with.
Right, exactly.
But I think, I mean, with the Southern Molyneux incident last year, given our sort of lack of critical thinking ability in this day and age, and hey, look, let's not get fussy about it. Let's not aim for critical thinking. Let's just aim for thinking in general now in many sectors. But what I understand people's inability to differentiate between what they were saying and their right to say it. And I think it was unfortunate, I guess, that based on what they were saying and a lot of people supporting not necessarily what they had to say but their right to say it, it was positioned as, I guess, a right-wing cause, free speech and so on. Now, of course, one of the arguments at the time and around free speech issues often is the slippery slope, that once you start to censor speech, who's safe? And we're seeing that exact thing playing out now, I think, where, like I said, if women getting together to talk about things that they're concerned about is an issue and is a free speech issue, and people will say that that's hate speech, where does it stop?
Yeah, exactly.
You cannot say, and it's such an old argument, that you cannot say that something's hate speech just because you disagree with it. And I think that's what we're seeing increasingly more. And not only that, but also, to me, the fact that, the advancement of transgender rights, if you like, and let's not get into the intricacies of the issues of human rights, but that's problematic in itself. But if we accept, you know, that there's the transgender rights are advancing at quite a rapid pace, by definition, they impact on women's rights insofar as women's right to have sex, like women-only areas. Okay, so I don't think that anybody can disagree with that. If we're suddenly allowing people who are biologically men into spaces that are typically for biological women, that's a fact. The issue, I think, becomes one of rights. Whose rights trump whose?
Right.
That's part of where identity politics comes into play as well. Once upon a time, women were seen as a marginalized group. Now, not even so close compared to transgender people.
So what do you think of the official reason that Massey had canceled the event was concerns of health and safety? They were concerned about the health and safety of the students and the wider community. Where do you think this idea that speech is violence has come from, and how do we reclaim that it's not?
Wow.
One more hard question, I'm sorry.
It's you're putting me on the spot this morning. I think, this is really thinking off the top of my head, and very much what I've observed, the little I've observed in this, and is that I think, like I said earlier, it's part of this bigger picture where if we're in schools and in universities, we're teaching children not how to think but what to think, and we're teaching them this is the opinion you have. And we've seen perfect examples of this recently with climate change. Now, not wanting to get into ins and outs of climate change,
right.
But we see young children with placards held up that they cannot possibly understand at that age, when you think that we have scientists, you know, spending their lives exploring these issues, and you've got this 5 or 6 or 7 year old holding up a placard that with this statement on it. They've obviously been told this is what to think. And then, of course, you have language like safe space and definitions of racism and violence and genocide and things constantly shifting to suit, I think, particular agenda and narratives these days. It all plays into this idea that why not? Why can't words be violence now?
If
you know, it's now racist just to question a woman of colour or a person of colour, if you like. why isn't the words that you're using now literally violence against them? And it's really quite frightening, because I think that I wonder the impact that this is going to have on people's mental health when we're really wrapping people in cotton wool and preventing them from engaging in discussion and building a sense of resilience in the world. Surely that's got to have quite a negative impact on people's mental health outcomes. I don't know. That's just a
no. I totally agree, and I definitely see your point that it's the, and I notice this in academics, that words continue to shift in their meaning. And the argument for it's like, well, words change their meaning all the time. It's the evolution of language.
Yeah.
That's not what you and I are talking about. We're talking about the change of the fundamental concept that these words were attached to in order to envelope a new or a broader, you know, meaning, which can now be used as a political weapon. It's almost as it reminds me of 1984. You know, there's a line or a quote. Isn't it beautiful, the destruction of words? And that's harrowing. What's going on? So we need to reclaim that, eh?
Definitely. Mm. I agree. And when you look at some of the language, so safe space, if you mention space, then the implication is, well, what are you advocating for? Unsafe spaces? Social injustice? So, you know, it's very cleverly worded language. And so it's quite hard to argue or to put forward an argument, I suppose, that doesn't invite the response that you're suddenly anti somebody's rights just by advocating for a conversation around things that you feel you have a right to discuss. So it's, you know, it's very cleverly done. And of course, one of the biggest shifts, I think, is the idea that racism, you know, that white people can't experience racism because racism has this idea of power, you know, tied into it. And that to me is one of the cleverest, you know, tricks in the book, because to me, and that goes back to my comment earlier about using the same stick that you were beaten with to beat other people with. If you replace words and some of the things that I read about how evil white people are, I guess you end up with, and replace it, I guess, with someone who's black or Maori or whatever the case may be. It's the definition of racism is obviously
almost
to discriminate against someone based
on
those things. It astounds me that people can't see it in reverse, if you like, not to get confused with reverse racism, of course.
Right.
It doesn't exist.
And it's unsatisfactory, because I think in academics, your response to something like that would be, well, I just don't agree with your premises. I'm not going to respond to you want social injustice, or I'm not going to respond to you want your anti-safe space. It's like, well, I don't agree with the accusation or the premises on which your accusation is based on. And that, unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be very satisfactory in the court of public opinion. It's like, well, what do you mean? You want to have a philosophical debate on the meaning of words? I'm talking about, you know, tangible, you know, justice or injustice that we're seeing here. So it's very, very difficult to go, well, hang on, you know.
Yeah, no, I agree. And it's, I mean, increasingly, I think one of the issues is that if you have people who don't value and who actually think it's logic and evidence and facts and rational thinking are evil, how do you use a logical, rational, you know, evidence-based factual argument to convince someone of something when you're not? And that's part of the difficulty, I think, in having these discussions these days, is that we're just so far increasingly apart from one another.
Yeah, and it's
getting more and more difficult.
Yeah, you have to almost, you know, set out the ground rules even before having a discussion in the first place. All right, these are the rules of logic that we're going to abide by within this scope here. And if you can't even agree to the rules, it's like no
exactly. And that, I think, is the key. We're in a place now where we can't even agree on the rules of engagement, let alone the need to engage and the benefits of engaging. So that's why I guess I wanted to go ahead with participating in the talk at Massey. Well, now not at Massey, now somewhere hopefully. Because I think it's important to get these messages out there, and gosh, if I can convince just one person from hearing what I've got to say about these things that maybe it is a good idea to try and have conversations and to try and connect with one another, and to convince them of the value of that, then hey, it's been worth it.
So, oh, definitely. Oh.
Yeah, I'm sure I'll cop a bit of flack for going ahead, and I've been called all sorts of names under the sun, as have other people speaking at the event, and Massey obviously disagrees with everything I've just said, but hey.
Right. Yeah, well, thank you so much, and I really do hope that you finally get to deliver your speech to whoever will listen, Melissa, because I think you're right. It is an important thing to, discussion to have, and you know, I just wish you the best of luck in convincing at least one person.
Thank you so much, and thank you so much for having me on today. It's been great.
If you like this podcast and wish to support the production of more episodes, you can go to www.freespeechcoalition.nz/join. Be sure to add us on Facebook and Twitter, and if you have any feedback, comments, or recommendations of other potential guests, email us at coalition@freespeechcoalition.nz. This has been the Free Speech Coalition Podcast. See you next time.